This is Radio 314 on the Red Ice Radio Network.
Hello, and thanks for choosing to listen to this program. I am Lana, and joining me is Keith Preston. Keith is the founder and director of American Revolutionary Vanguard, committed to advancing the principles of anti-statism, personal liberty, cooperative individualist economics, and the sovereignty and self-determination of communities and nations. He's a graduate student in history, an independent business owner and entrepreneur, an advocate of new radicalism that reaches beyond the archaic left-right model of the political spectrum. He is the author of Attack the System, A New Anarchist Perspective for the 21st Century. His website, attackthesystem.com, is full of well-written, interesting, and insightful essays. Welcome, Keith. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Lana. Thank you for having me on.
So how did you go from the far left side of politics to anti-statism?
Oh, well, I think I was probably born to be an anarchist. Emma Goldman, I once read many years ago where Emma Goldman, the classical anarchist, said that anarchists were born and not made. And I read that somewhere in some book about anarchism years ago, and I've tried to find the quote much later and haven't been able to find it. But I think that, though, that to some degree what she was saying was true, in the sense that I think the kinds of beliefs and value systems that people have in many ways reflect their own personality type and their own psychological makeup. And some of that's probably hardwired into us by genetics, and others may come from experience and that sort of thing. But I was always an anarchist or a libertarian or whatever you want to call me, but whatever the label you want to put on me is, at least by instinct. And in fact, I remember when I was in high school, the first time I ever heard of anything like that was, I first heard of libertarians probably around the year 1980. I remember I was in a hotel room watching a Good Morning America, or one of those morning talk shows, whichever ones would have been around back then. And it was about the presidential election that year, and Ronald Reagan was running against Jimmy Carter. And I remember they brought this fellow on who was the Libertarian Party candidate that year, and thinking, wow, this guy's pretty interesting. He's got a lot of, he talks, he doesn't say things normal politicians say. And then a few years later, I was probably a senior in high school, and I remember in my English literature book reading about William Godwin. I was actually reading about Shelley, and in this, there was this little brief snippet that mentioned that Shelley was the son-in-law of William Godwin, the anarchist. And I remember thinking, wow, there's really people like that. That sounds interesting. I'll have to check that out at some point. And then when I was in college, I did what many college students do. I started getting interested in philosophy and politics and trying to figure out how the world works and all that kind of stuff. And I remembered hearing about these anarchist people, and I started looking that up in very generic sources like the encyclopedia and stuff like that. Of course, this was years before the internet. And I remember reading about Proudhon and classical anarchism. And then I started meeting other anarchists. And then I started meeting people from the libertarian movement, which was a movement that had some overlapping ideas. Other people with similar views. And I just kind of took it from there. And I started reading anything I could find on these kinds of topics. I remember being in my early 20s, sitting in a library and reading, and if you go, even to this day, if you go to a university library, if you go to the HX833 section, you can find all these books on anarchism. And then I think if you go to a JC599 section, you can find plenty of books on libertarianism and classical liberalism and stuff of that type. And that's really how I accumulated all of this knowledge and all of this stuff that I write about and talk about today, is just doing very boring and nerdy things like sitting in a library reading books.
Well, today we have many forms of anarchism, libertarianism, we have minarchists, voluntarism, et cetera, et cetera. And one thing they all have in common is they all have issues with the state. So how the heck do you suggest bringing all these groups together to get some real work accomplished?
Well, that's a good question, and that's something that I've written about quite a bit, because Over the years, I always noticed that one aspect of the thinking of anarchists and libertarians was that was rather deficient was in the area of strategy. A lot of people from those kinds of backgrounds or those kinds of movements or orientations tend to be either very intellectual. They're very into philosophy and economic theory and stuff like that, and or else they tend to be rather activist minded, and they go out and they do run of the mill activism that people in any kind of movement, regardless of what it is, would do. So I started thinking about, well, we need to have some kind of, well, plus I also noticed how many different types of beliefs there were about anarchism and libertarianism. And I started thinking, well, something needs to happen to bring all this together into some kind of unified movement, or some kind of movement that can focus on some common issues. And that's why I started writing about some of the stuff that I write about. And there are large sections of the book deal with that issue. So I started coming up with this idea that I call pan-secessionism, and this concept called pan-anarchism. I also call it anarcho-pluralism, where it's okay. The message behind that is that it's okay to have different types of libertarianism or different types of anarchism, and it's not necessary for everyone to agree on everything. And I tend to be critical of points of view that pound away at a very universalist outlook, saying people will always be different, and there's always going to be people that have conflicting opinions about lots of different things. And even people that have very similar philosophies are still individuals, and they're still going to have different ideas and different perceptions. But I prefer to see libertarians and anarchists pick out issues that everyone can agree on, or that they're perhaps are the most pressing in many ways. For example, war. Most anarchists, most libertarians are very opposed to aggressive war, imperialistic war, and things like that. And there's folks like the people at antiwar.com that do very good work criticizing that kind of thing. And I'd like to see more unity of anarchists and libertarians around these kinds of ideas and developing some concrete ideas as to how to go about breaking down the state.
So what are the core strategic efforts for this pan-anarchist movement?
The term pan-anarchism, like I said, it recognizes all the different types of anarchism and all the different strands of anarchism, and it doesn't really expect anyone to endorse any one idea of that type, and in fact recognizes that there are conflicts between many of the different types of anarchism and things that often seem polar opposite in many ways. But that's okay, because what we advocate for is this wider concept called pan-secessionism, which is all about different kinds of people forming their own communities and their own institutions, structured in the way they want to have them, but in a way that's mutually supportive of other people with similar institutions, or even polar opposite institutions, but who share a common enemy or who share the common goal of self-determination. I was having a discussion recently with someone that I know who's he's actually a Scandinavian, and he's a conservative, a cultural conservative, and he's interested in libertarianism, and he was saying, for me, it's not just about what the proper role of the state in society is. I'm also interested in wider questions of civilization and things like that. I'm like, well, sure, and so am I. And that's, to a large degree, is what pan-anarchism is about. It's not just about being against the state. It's about self-determination for all people everywhere and for all individuals everywhere. And, it's not really about the idea that any one group or any one person gets to dictate what other people say or what other people do. Maybe somebody somewhere wants to have a state. That's for different communities to decide for themselves. But the concept of pan-secessionism is different from pan-anarchism in the sense that it's not really an ideology or philosophy per se. It's a tactical concept. It's a strategic concept. And it's simply about federations of communities and movements that oppose centralized political authority simply walking away from that authority. As Americans, that's what we did back in 1776. We had our 13 colonies that just walked away from the British Empire. And to some degree, that's what happened in Eastern Europe and in the Soviet Union in the late 20th century. You had the 15 Soviet republics that more or less just walked away from the Soviet Union. The the nations of the Warsaw Pact walked away from the Soviet Empire as well. And now, to some degree, that's because the Soviets let them go because they knew the end was near and it wasn't worth fighting to keep all that together. But so there are plenty of historical precedents for this kind of thing, very profound historical precedents. I know it's interesting because whenever I talk about this kind of stuff with a lot of people, a lot of people seem to have trouble grasping these kinds of ideas. Often I think the mistake they make is they try to make it more complicated than it needs to be. Nothing I really talk about is all that difficult. For example, here in the United States, we look at the political coalitions that are maintained by the ruling parties, by the Democrats and Republicans. And what we see are both of those parties are basically coalitions of political interest groups that have some common interest in opposing each other, basically. If you look at the things on the Republican side, it's not exactly clear what working class Southerners and Midwestern Chamber of Commerce folks and Manhattan billionaires have in common with each other. Yeah. Other than being against the Democrats, they see the Democrat, they see the left liberal side as being some kind of threat to their own either cultural, religious, or economic interests. And the same thing is probably even more true on the left. If we look at all the different kinds of political factions and interest groups that make up the left, what exactly do Hollywood media moguls and owners of high-tech companies and Silicon Valley entrepreneurs on one hand, and then poor people in the inner city and public sector workers and young urban professionals and Jewish liberals and Muslim immigrants, and Hispanics and Black people and gay people and feminists and a pornographer like Larry Flint, what do all of these people have in common with each other? Well, nothing, except they see the other side as the common threat. They mm-hmm. see the traditional WASP, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant culture, or the traditional elite as their common enemy. And that's really all I'm talking about anarchists and libertarians doing, and that's the idea of identifying that we have this common enemy in the state and in the ruling class. I posted a thing on Attack the System a couple of days ago, a Gallup poll that identified what issues are at present of most concern to Americans. And the issues that were overwhelmingly the most popular were the ones that are in some way critical of the elite. Either they dealt with economic issues like health care or unemployment or the budget deficits, or they dealt with simply with the idea of an incompetent or oppressive government. So it looks like opinion in many ways is starting to shift where, however people feel about each other, they hate the system worse. I noticed that a lot of the standard hot button culture war type issues really didn't get as high a ranking in this particular poll. So what I'm advocating for is a political realignment that pits everyone that has a grievance against the state, against centralized authority, and so forth, really into the same camp, the same kind of coalition, just like these other political factions do.
How do you get together, though, these anarcho-socialist communist types with these individualist types? We really clash against each other,
Yeah, it's interesting because I look at I belong to a lot of different Facebook groups that and online discussion forums, not to mention real life groups that deal with these kinds of issues. And you see these socialist anarchists and free market libertarians arguing back and forth. And the way that I resolve all of these questions, and it's not just the different economic philosophies like the different theories of socialism or capitalism, and all these different groups are going back and forth about I'm more anarchist than you and those sorts of things. But the way I deal with these questions is through the wider principles of decentralization, freedom of association, mutual sovereignty, and so forth. These are standard anarchist principles that all the traditional classical anarchists claim to believe in. These are standard principles that many libertarians claim to believe in as well. So I think as long as we respect those principles of free association, of decentralization, of mutual aid, and so forth, as well as this wider strategic concept of pan-secessionism, localism, and all that, which at least in our own political culture in the United States fits into American political history and political culture quite well. I think that that really is the meta paradigm with which these kinds of conflicts can be managed. You know, people who, that believe in primitivism and anarcho-primitivism, they want to live in a community where we all live in mud huts and stuff like that. All right, that's not the choice I'd make for myself. I know people who believe in that. And if that's what they want to do and that's their ideal and that's their utopia, then fine, they can have that. You know, I know other people that are very futuristic and they're very into this thing called transhumanism and envision a world where someday we're going to have anarchist colonies on the moon and, you know, we're going to have our, you know, we're not going to have to work anymore because we're going to have robots doing it all for us and that kind of stuff. And, you know, whether the, any of those visions ever turn out to be feasible or not, I'd say let them have their vision and their utopia as well.
Exactly. The idea here is to work to abolish the state and then give every political interest group its own territory to be able to create whatever society they wish, correct?
Right, exactly. Yes, exactly.
So if you want to have your religious community or your communist or your lesbian separatism, you know, you can have it, but just don't tell me what to do and don't make me pay for it, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, that's really the unifying principle behind all of this.
I'm going to read something from your writing. Anarcho-pluralism advocates radical localism as the best possible method of avoiding the tyrannies and abuses of overarching Leviathan states and accommodating the irreconcilable differences concerning any number of matters that all societies inevitably contain. Can you explain what radical localism is?
Well, it's really just the standard anarchist idea that political authority should be stripped down to the local, the smallest local unit possible, if not abolished entirely. That's really the one of the core ideas behind philosophical anarchism. You know, when we seek to define our terms, you know, we can use the terms libertarian and anarchism in a lot of different ways. You know, I suppose libertarianism is a broader concept. It's for a label for someone that thinks individual liberty is the highest political value, maybe not the only political value, maybe not the highest value of any kind. They may think there are ethical or religious or philosophical values that are even more important. But then anarchism is the idea, well, we should either abolish the state altogether or just strip it down to the bare minimum level we can get away with or localize it to the greatest degree possible. And that's what I'm talking about in that passage that you quoted. It's about the idea of stripping down political authority to the smallest possible unit we can possibly get by with. Just, you know, strip one layer off after another until we get down to the bare minimum. And last one out turns off the lights.
So how do you recommend beginning to dismantle or take apart the state at this point?
Well, we have to, first of all, understand that the state is extremely complex. You know, it's the state isn't just, you know, this isn't the 19th century. The state isn't just the king or the parliament or something like that. You know, in the back in the heyday of classical anarchism in the late 19th and early 20th century, you know, you had people that that practiced what they call propaganda by the deed. That was the idea. Well, if the, you know, if we want to get rid of the state, we just assassinate the king. You know, I don't approve of that kind of thing anyway, but you know, that was, and that even then that was a very naive and very foolish outlook. You know, we have to understand that what the state is. The state is a vast array of institutions, layer upon layer of organizations that are interconnected to one another. You know, we have the political class itself, you know, the politicians and all that. We have the bureaucratic class that runs parallel to that. We also have a vast array of state-allied institutions or institutions that are heavily intertwined with the state. You know, a lot of the corporate sector, certainly a lot of the educational sector, a lot of the media sector, and all of that collectively is how I is what I describe as being the state. But the way to do that is to chip away at all of these things one by one. And there's different people, different groups, different movements that have their focus in particular areas. There are some people, for example, who focus on opposing aggressive warfare and who focus on opposing the excessive military-industrial complex that we have in the United States. There are other people who criticize the welfare state. There are other people who criticize corporate welfare. There are people who criticize central banking. There's people who criticize the prison-industrial complex or the police state or the war on drugs or violations of personal freedom in terms of sumptuary legislation, you know, whether it's laws prohibiting selling raw milk or vice laws or online gambling or whatever. There are people out there that are for smokers' rights, the right to smoke cigarettes in a bar or something like that. There are civil liberties organizations from the left, from the right, that deal with issues that are important to them that they specialize in. And I think that it's through the process of strengthening all of these kinds of activities that, are chipping away at the state in a lot of different corners in their own way, and then perhaps pulling them towards one another so that there's a greater realization that there is this common enemy or this common apparatus, this common institutional apparatus that they're all attacking. I think that's really how we can go about growing a much more comprehensive and unified libertarian movement that does have the effect of breaking down these massive state institutions that dominate modern societies.
And with that, we have to have an effective resistance right now so that the state doesn't encroach on our space even more, correct?
Oh, absolutely. And that's very important to resist the state in so many different kinds of ways. I had someone on my podcast program a while back that was talking about how she is involved in activism in her particular town. The police are actually going around confiscating blankets from homeless people so they can't sleep on the street when it's cold outside. Just focusing on something like that, something as basic as that. There are other organizations out there that specialize in providing legal defense to people who come under the attack by the state. We were talking off the air before the program started about homeschooling, about how in some countries homeschooling is illegal. And the only reason that it's legal in the United States is because homeschoolers in the United States have actually had a fairly well-organized movement that has defended their own rights to practice homeschooling. And what's interesting, too, about the homeschooling movement is that it's a movement where people who are otherwise very different from one another have actually come together around this common issue. In the homeschooling movement, you'll find some people who are from the far right politically, people who are very, very religious, very conservative in many ways. You'll also find people from the counterculture, very hippie-ish, very left-wing in many ways. And yet it's these people that have managed to come together and defend the right to do homeschooling because as they understand they need each other in order to keep themselves out of jail. That kind of activism has turned out to be fairly successful. And we need activism of that type. Legal defense organizations for folks from all over the spectrum who come under the attack by the state. And it's interesting, too, because I'm always heartened when I see civil liberties organizations moving towards one another around some common issues. I know the National Rifle Association, which defends the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms, and the American Civil Liberties Union, which is a more left-wing civil liberties group that deals more with the due process issues and the Fifth Amendment or the Sixth Amendment, things like that. They actually came together to defend a lot of the basic constitutional rights when things like some of the anti-terrorism legislation, like the Patriot Act and all that, were being put into power. But what we need to do is grow and expand all these kinds of activities. So a big part of my own strategy is simply to promote all forms of anarchism, all forms of libertarianism, all forms of anti-statism, decentralism, any kind of activism around any kind of issue that I think is worth supporting, as well as this broader strategic concept of pan-secessionism and radical decentralization of power, for the purpose of, as I said earlier, to break down this overarching state apparatus that we have.
Now, you've mentioned, too, that the real threat is our own ruling class of totalitarian humanists. Can you talk about this?
Yeah, well, one way that the powers that be in any kind of society maintain power is they always claim to be defending the people and the public good against some great threat. It can be the enemy within. It can be the enemy without. From the left wing of the establishment, we often hear the threat of supposed neo-Nazis and groups like that. And there are organizations out there that are always trying to fan hysteria about how racists and neo-fascists are going to take over society. In earlier times, it was communists. In American history, there's this lengthy tradition of periodic red scares that would heat up and about how the communists are going to take over the world. That doesn't really fly as well now because most of those regimes have disappeared. And of course, the neocons have often fanned the flames about the Muslims and, you know, and the Islamic threat, and the those on the liberal wing of us, the establishment, has frequently attacked the religious right, the Christian fundamentalists. All these different kinds of groups are always held up as some great enemy of freedom of civilization or whatever. And there are others as too. I remember in the 80s in the United States, we had this thing called the Satanic Panic about how there were supposedly satanic cults going around kidnapping children and things like that. And then there was the war on drugs, you know, and how drugs are going to destroy civilization. I've seen that plenty of this kind of stuff just in my own lifetime. But the in most societies, most of the time, your main enemy is always going to be your own government and your own ruling class. They're the ones that are out to get you. They're the ones that are on the closest to you. That may not always be the case if you live in a nation that's, say, being subject to genuine occupation by a foreign power, or, you know, attack by an external state that's of extremely vicious nature. You know, that can happen as well, but most of the time it's going to be your own government that's your primary enemy. And when I talk about this concept called totalitarian humanism, that's really just my term for PC, for political correctness. If I had to break down what totalitarian humanism is in a nutshell, I'd say it's a political philosophy, at least an implicit political philosophy, that says that the state must forever be centralized and power must be continually concentrated in order to enforce ostensibly progressive values. For example, the state must interfere in and control other centers of power and competing institutions in order to enforce progressive values. The homeschooling thing is a good example. The state will argue, well, no, we can't have homeschooling because that means some kids won't get a quality education, and then the homeschools will teach them bad values, things that are antisocial and we don't like. They'll teach them backward, superstitious religious beliefs and unscientific ideas, or they'll teach them disrespect for authority and teach them to use drugs or, you know, something like that. Those are the kinds of rationales you hear behind attacking the homeschooling movement. You also see that the rationale behind centralizing political power in an institutional sense. Oh, no, we can't respect the sovereignty of states and localities or regions or provinces because somebody somewhere might engage in racial discrimination or discrimination against gay people or something like that. This kind of thinking is also used now as a justification for war, as a foreign policy tool. Well, we've got to go and attack these other countries because we want to show them how wonderful democracy and human rights are. like Christopher Hitchens, for example, was an illustration of someone who thinks like that. He when the war in Afghanistan was going on, he would say, well, we're going to go over there and bomb them out of the Stone Age. You know, for their own good, we're going to drop all these bombs on them and invade and occupy their country, you know, just to show them how great we are and how enlightened we are. And we're going to bring all these wonders to their society as well. And of course, it doesn't really work that way. And anybody with an inkling of history and historical knowledge knows that it doesn't work that way. But that's what totalitarian humanism is. It's this idea that the state must interfere in society at every level, in every area of life, and even go to war in the name of promoting ostensibly progressive, you know, egalitarian, democratic, universalistic values. It also advocates regulating personal lives in this way. For instance, we see the efforts that we see the food police that are coming along now, like a New York City was notorious for this, where they're trying to ban soda machines and say there can't be but so much sugar in a soft drink. I think they tried to keep 7-Elevens from selling Slurpees and keep vending machines out of schools. And you see that with smoking. Nobody can smoke in a bar anymore. I mean, it may make sense to say you can't smoke in a hospital with people with breathing disorders around, but saying you can't smoke in a bar or something like that is a bit of a reach. We see that in terms of morals laws. You know, a lot of times, you know, most libertarians are tend to be very critical of so-called consensual crimes or sumptuary legislation is the proper legal term for it. But the traditional prohibitions against, say, alcohol or drugs or vice laws or gambling or something like that. But now we see a lot of the left coming along and trying to. You know, traditionally that was thought of as more of a conservative thing. You know, well, it's the very conservative, socially conservative people, very religious, believe very strongly in traditional morality and things like that. You know, they want to keep pornography out of the. You know, they don't want anybody selling Playboy magazine at the drugstore or anything like that. You know, but nowadays you see that kind of thing coming just as frequently from the left. You have these feminist crusades for the censorship of pornography. You've got a lot of people out there defending drug prohibition on the grounds of not so much morals and law and order as much as health. You know, we got to for example, I know in New Hampshire recently, I think the legislature introduced a bill to decriminalize marijuana, and the governor there said, "Well, no, I'm going to veto that because you can't have the kids out there smoking pot. That's a terrible thing."
Oh, and I thought the Free State Project was hip to that, so I guess not.
Yeah, well, I think this is just the governor of that particular state. I don't think it's the I don't think it's necessarily the public as a whole, but that's the kind of thinking that we see from a lot of these kinds of people that I'm labeling totalitarian humanist. And of course, you know, the obvious examples are all the PC stuff in some European countries now they have these hate speech laws where for example, Sweden, I know that if clerics, Christian or Islamic clerics, if they say something that's critical of homosexuality, they can actually go to jail for that. And I think that's the case in England as well. I saw a lecture recently by online lecture by my friend Dr. Sean Gabb of the Libertarian Alliance in England was talking about a case like that of a Christian minister is being persecuted for having less than favorable things to say about homosexuality,
even though that's their religion.
So. Right. Even though there in England, technically, they still have a state religion, Christianity, at least in the Anglican form, is still technically the state religion. Although I think this particular person he was talking about doesn't belong to that tradition itself, but we see one of my favorite recent examples was Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan is an icon of the 60s counterculture, on all the liberation and all that supposedly came out of that. And now the French are trying to file charges against him for racism over something he said, I believe, in a magazine interview. It was a very innocuous comment about the civil war in Yugoslavia, the former Yugoslavia, between the Croatians and the Serbs. And I don't remember all the details, but they're trying to say he was denigrating the one of the sides. I think it was he was expressing racist comments about the Croatians, and now they want to bring him up on charges of racism. I know in France, Brigitte Bardot, the former actress, who, as an advocate of animal rights and animal welfare and those kinds of things, has been brought up on criminal charges, I believe, of racism on multiple times for criticizing some of the practices regarding animal husbandry that some of the Muslim immigrant communities practice. Which, that's not even about how you feel about Muslims or how you feel about animals or anything like that. You know, it's just about, can't someone have an opinion? It's like, apparently not.
Yeah, exactly. You can't just not like someone or something anymore. But by the way, people can say anything about white people, no problem. And it's never racist, you know?
Well, yeah, it's interesting that I think all societies have their own ideological superstructure that legitimate the state in the particular society. And I think this is one thing the Marxists actually get right, is that Marx said that in any particular society, the ruling class is going to have this ideology that legitimize its existence and its system of power, and it's always going to reflect the interests of the people who hold power at the particular time. And of course, he was talking in terms of socioeconomic classes. But I think, though, that he was right about that, at least. And right now in the modern Western countries, we have this ideology of totalitarian humanism. I mean, they don't call it that, obviously. That's what I call it. But but the implicit behind that is this this kind of victimological narrative. And I think this kind of thing is traceable back to the it really goes back to the cultural upheavals that happened in the 60s and 70s, where, and all of that now has, the people who participated in a lot of those movements somehow gotten old now. You know, someone that was 20 years old in 1968 is now 65 years old. So those people are now the elderly generation, and they've essentially become the establishment in a lot of different kinds of ways. And a lot along the way, as they've joined the establishment, they've brought this kind of left-wing historical narrative with them, where nowadays you don't really see the state or the ruling class trying to maintain its power in the name of tradition and traditional values or conservative sounding things like that, or religion or whatever. Now it's all about overcoming oppression and rectifying past wrongs and making sure everyone's equal and nobody's ever discriminated against and no one ever hates anybody. And then they bring this environmentalist narrative into it as well. They bring this therapeutic idea into it that, health is the highest value and nobody can ever be allowed to hurt their health in any particular way, the therapeutic nanny state. All of these kinds of things now have kind of converged into form this ideological superstructure that legitimizes the present system of rule. And that's what I call totalitarian humanism. And of course, white people are excluded from that because they're not considered an oppressed group. It's like you have, it's like you now have the officially oppressed, you have some people that are considered to be oppressed just by virtue of belonging to a certain group. For example, black people are oppressed, even though an individual black person might be a very wealthy, successful attorney or something like that. Well, he's oppressed just on the basis of skin color alone, irrespective of his own life circumstances. And I think that's actually one of the biggest flaws in this kind of thinking, is that it just makes very blanket, very wide assumptions about people, irrespective of their individual circumstances, irrespective of what they personally do. If someone is in circumstances that are difficult or have disadvantages, maybe that's due to circumstances beyond their control. Maybe it's not. Maybe there are certain subsets of different population groups that can be considered to be oppressed. I mean, on the race issue, for example, certainly the fact that we have so many young black people in the American prison system for rather petty things, possession or sale of drugs and things like that. Certainly, we can say that is a form of oppression, and it overlaps with something like racism. But on the other hand, to say that all women are oppressed just by virtue of being women, or all gay people are being oppressed, even though gays are, if anything, are overrepresented in popular culture, in the media, to the point now I saw a survey recently that showed that 1 in 4 Americans the average American now thinks that 1 in 4 people are gay or something like that, which is a way off of what the actual the real statistical data shows. And I think it's because gays have so much representation in media and in entertainment and things like that, and that I'm not necessarily knocking that itself, but it is interesting how we just nowadays, instead of singling out particular groups to attack, instead, we single out particular groups to say, well, these people are all oppressed and nobody can ever say anything critical about them. And and whites don't really fit into that narrative. Poor, uneducated, working class white people certainly don't fit into that narrative. People from the South don't really fit into that narrative. People, members of fringe religious movements that have un-PC views about a lot of things, like say homosexuality, they're not considered part of that narrative. Even though many of those classes of people face as much social or political or economic discrimination as any of the officially oppressed classes do at this particular.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, and then we have the godfather of the left, a German Jew by the name of Herbert Marcuse. It's funny because you write about him. We just watched a mini documentary about him last night, and his tolerance of repression. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, Herbert Marcuse was a Jewish German, who was one of the leading theoreticians behind the Frankfurt School. For those that have never gone to graduate school, whether we actually study all that stuff in detail, it's a bit of an obscure topic to the average layperson. But the Frankfurt School was a Marxist think tank that was formed in Germany during the interwar period, in the period between the First and Second World War. And Marcuse was one of the leading theoreticians of this. There were a lot of others that are well known in academic circles. There's Eric Fromm, the psychologist, Wilhelm Reich. There was Max Horkheimer, Theodor Adorno, some others. Walter Benjamin, they were all associated with this Frankfurt School, this neo-Marxist think tank. But what differentiated the Frankfurt School from the Orthodox Marxists? You know, Orthodox Marxism is really not what's passed off as Marxism in a lot of academic circles today. As hardline communists will still tell you, Orthodox Marxism sees everything in terms of material relationships between socioeconomic classes, and they have this very narrow economic determinism. It's all about economics. That's not how the kind of revisionist Marxism that you see from movements like what came out of the Frankfurt School believe. They believe that culture is paramount, and they don't see everything in terms of economic conflict. And one of the ideas that was developed during the on the far left during the interwar period after World War One, not by the Frankfurt School, also by some other thinkers of the far left. One was Antonio Gramsci, an Italian communist theoretician. The idea was that the reason the workers had not yet carried out a socialist revolution in Western Europe was because they had been imbibed with what they call false consciousness. And false consciousness meant they really just weren't able to identify what their own real interests were. According to Marxism, the interest of the working class is to overthrow capitalism and create a socialist state. According to a hardline Marxist, that would be what working people should think is in their self-interest. The neo-Marxist theoreticians that came out of some of these movements, these interwar movements, believed that the reason the workers couldn't really see that, the reason that workers often tended to be more conservative, even more so than capitalists, that capitalists were often to the left of the working class on some issues. And the reason, for example, that during the First World Wars, the working classes of all the different countries rallied behind their own particular nations, the reason that the socialist parties actually supported their respective countries in the war, had to do with the fact that workers had been given this false consciousness by institutions, by the media. Well, they didn't have the media the way we understand it back then, but by the educational system, by traditional culture, by things like patriotism, by traditional values, by organized religion in particular. So as a result, workers weren't really able to identify their own interests. So the belief was that either one or two things had to happen. All right, Gramsci's view was that the radical left needed to first capture the cultural institutions. They needed to go and get control of education and means of disseminating ideas to inculcate in the people the ideas that they figured were correct and reflected their true self-interest, their true socialist self-interest. Some of the thinkers of the Frankfurt School did, most notably Marcuse, was to develop an alternative theory of revolution, which was that this is an idea that Marcuse promoted throughout much of his career, and that was that the workers had been bought off by capitalism, that capitalism had managed to raise living standards high enough that the workers really weren't going to carry out a revolution. They were too contented with what they had. So workers were no longer a revolutionary force. So if you really wanted to make a socialist revolution, you had to find other populations for the sake of carrying out the socialist revolution. And the obvious ones would be the oppressed groups of the time, we're talking about the mid-20th century here. That would have been racial minorities, particularly in a country like the United States, women, homosexuals, young people, college students, alienated intellectuals, precisely all of the population groups that tended to make up the radical movements of the 1960s, when all of that started to appear, when the new left started to grow. And Marcosa himself was one of the primary intellectual theoreticians of the new left, and a lot of college students and academics and intellectuals in that time period really took what he said to heart, and that was the basis of a lot of their ideas that came out of that movement, at least on the intellectual level. Now Marcosa also had this idea that he called repressive tolerance, and in a nutshell, what repressive tolerance means is you should show tolerance for people who are enlightened and progressive and things like that. But you don't need to show tolerance for people who aren't. I believe he said what he actually said is that, well, we need to show tolerance for movements of the left and not show tolerance for movements of the right. Mm-hmm. And of course, movements of the right meant anything that were in conflict with this fairly narrowly defined left-wing agenda that he had as well. There is some nuance to this. Marcuse was not an apologist for Eastern Marxism. He was not an apologist for the Soviet Union, for the states of Eastern Europe. I don't even know that he shared a lot of the enthusiasm for third world communism that you found among a lot of student radicals in the 60s, like the ones that were devotees of Mao and Che Guevara and Ho Chi Minh and that kind of stuff. But he did advocate specifically suppressing the political rights of people and organizations and movements that he found insufficiently progressive. And he says that very clearly. A lot of these thinkers from the Frankfurt School, if you delve into their writings, they're not particularly clear writers. And a lot of times it's really hard to figure out what they're even saying. It's not the case with Marcosa. His writings are fairly clear. But in his writings, particularly in this essay, Repressive Tolerance, he makes it very, very clear that he's advocating the suppression of the political rights of people that are deemed insufficiently progressive. And he's not just talking about right-wing totalitarian movements or movements that are, you know, clearly sinister in nature, movements advocating genocide and things like that. He's not just talking about Nazis and stuff like that. He's talking about people that oppose the welfare state, mm-hmm. people who have, you know, less than progressive views on things like race, gender, gay rights. I think he even mentions the handicapped and all this kind of stuff. You know, all this kind of stuff that we associate with PC today, this kind of radical egalitarianism, you know, that there's nothing we can do, you know, no matter, you know, the implicit assumption behind PC is no matter how much we do individually or as a society to help people who are deemed oppressed, it's still not good enough. You know, it's like the battle that will never be won. You know, it's kind of like in some of the really stringent forms of religion. You know, no matter how many repentance you do, no matter how many times you go to church, no matter how much fasting you do, you know, no matter whether you pray 15 times a day, it's still not good enough. You know, sin will always be there. And I think that that's really the kind of thinking we see among a lot of these PC movements as well. No matter what we do, it's not enough. And any other point of view, you know, any other point of view that criticizes some of this and raises questions like, well, look, wait a minute. You know, maybe groups that were once oppressed really aren't so oppressed anymore, mm-hmm. you know, given changes in the society, given that society is fluid, it doesn't remain static. But given that society is fluid, maybe some of these groups that have been clearly oppressed in the past aren't quite as oppressed now, or at least not as oppressed as they once were. Maybe not everybody within them is oppressed. Maybe in fact there's been some excesses in that area. Maybe the pendulum has swung too far the other way in areas. Of course, to the PC ideology, to totalitarian humanism, as I call it, this is blasphemy. This is every bit as bad as expressing heretical religious opinions in the Middle Ages might have been. And Marcosa was a specific advocate of legal and political repression of unprogressive opinion. If you read Marcosa's writing, it's clear that he believed that in a society that, of the type that he envisioned, people that are deemed sexist, racist, fascist, reactionary, conservative, right-wing, unprogressive, whatever, simply have no rights. They don't have the right of free speech. They don't have the right of freedom of association. They don't have any political rights at all. That's really what Marcosa was advocating. And we see that kind of thinking being applied more and more in Western societies today. We see, in those institutions where this kind of thinking has the most dominant, is the ones where we see this kind of thinking being applied to the greatest extreme. The one example is the university system and speech codes and that kind of thing, and how you can be run out of a university if you say something that's deemed sexist or racist or homophobic or whatever. In the United States, in some of the family courts where radical feminism has gained a very strong precedence. We see the effort to criminalize men. All men are basically depicted as wife beaters and child molesters and, just god awful creatures. And in countries where this kind of thinking has the greatest influence, that's where we see hate speech and that kind of thing being criminalized to the greatest degree. For example, the Holocaust denial laws. I'm not a Holocaust denier, by the way. I don't really think that point of view has a lot to stand on. But what's interesting is that in countries like France, you see that these kinds of laws being implemented that criminalize Holocaust denial, and these laws were often enacted, introduced into parliament by the communist deputies in some of those countries initially, and then started to spread. We see, like in England, we see laws being introduced that criminalize, or in Sweden, that criminalize any criticism of homosexuality. We're not talking about crime. We're not talking about people that go out and beat up gay people and things like that. Yeah, we're just talking about opinions.
Police.
Right, exactly. It's like if a cleric, a Christian or Islamic cleric, says, "Well, I don't believe in or agree with homosexuality for religious reasons," just like I don't believe in not going to church on Sunday. I think everybody should go to church on Sunday. Well, that's a criminal offense in some of these systems now, and that reflects the influence of people like Marcosa. I think PC has its roots in other things as well, besides the Frankfurt School. I don't want to lay all the blame for it there. I think that in some ways it's sort of a heretical offshoot of certain Christian traditions, particularly the kind of Christian pietism that's a big part of American cultural history and Puritanism and things like that. You can say it's sort of a secularized Puritanism, where it's all about wiping out sin and wiping out the impure and the imperfect and stuff like that.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I see this kind of attitude, this quote-unquote progressive type of opinion being exhibited by the Obama regime. And if you tell people that you're an anarchist, they right away say, "Oh, you're one of those right-wing extremists," right?
Well, it's interesting how the term anarchist has come to be labeled as a right-wing extremist concept because, 100 years ago, anarchists were considered a movement of the far left, and they were put in the same category with communists and people like that. In the United States, during the era of Woodrow Wilson, during the First World War, there was one of the big red scares that I was talking about earlier took place, and you had anarchists being rounded up by the federal police, and the ones who were immigrants were being deported. Emma Goldman and some of her associates were sent back to Russia. So anarchism back then was considered a movement of the far left. But nowadays, You're absolutely correct. You see people in Congress, Obama partisans, denouncing, you know, very middle of the road groups like the Tea Party as these anarchists, you know, or denouncing the Republicans as anarchists, you know, which is ridiculous. Being an anarchist, I'm sympathetic to anarchists, so I don't consider it a pejorative. But you know, there's no way that you can really label something like the Tea Party as just a very middle of the road, right of center conservative movement as anarchist. I'm sure there's probably some anarcho-capitalists somewhere that participate in that, or certainly some libertarians. Now that's becoming a pejorative as well. And I think, you know, one of the reasons for it is that the government has become so unpopular. It's interesting to see how unpopular the government has become, at least in the United States, over time. I was looking a while back at some information that showed that back in 1972, the poll was taken that showed that most people said they could trust the government most of the time. I think something like 75% of the U.S. population in 1972 felt like the government was genuinely trustworthy and tried to do the right thing. And this was even after the height of the Vietnam War and all of the upheavals of the 60s and that kind of stuff. Nowadays, when you look at the approval ratings of the government, sometimes it's not even in the double digits. You know, sometimes it's 8%. If you ask people, well, can the government trusted to do the right thing? 8% will say, maybe so, and the other 92 will say no.
But they keep paying taxes and obeying.
Well, what's interesting about that is it's interesting to see how, on one hand, the political class continues to lose its legitimacy and becomes increasingly unpopular. I think alternative media and just the media, the growth of media and technology generally, has had a lot to do with that. It's a lot harder for them to cover things up now than it once was. And I think a lot of the media is not as complicit, actually, in covering things up. I think now the media tends to be very partisan, in the sense that, that you've got MSNBC, which is very CNN, which are very loyal to the Democrats. You've got Fox, which is very loyal to the Republicans. You've got a lot of alternative media that doesn't care much for either one. So I think that there's a lot, the growth of alternative media and the greater diversification of the media has made it more difficult for the government to cover its own tracks. Back when they just had three television networks and they were all rather sycophantic. So I think the system has continued to lose its legitimacy, and a lot of it's been through just sheer ineptitude. I mean, it just becomes more and more obvious. They just don't know what they're doing much of the time. Even after September 11th, I think there was a upsurge of patriotism, or whatever you'd want to call it, after that happened. And I remember some liberal progressive commentators who believe in big government at the time saying, "Yes, well, this is actually kind of heartening, because people are restoring their faith in the government." And what happened? What happened after that? The government went off and got involved in two wars and screwed them up, and people nowadays are saying, well, maybe not so fast. And add to that the economic collapse of back in 2008 and the bailouts and the stimulus package and just the flagrant cronyism and flagrant corruption involved in that. I mean, to the point they weren't even trying to hide it. Plus, we see more and more examples of repression being brought to the surface. We see this growth of the police state, and we see incidents of police brutality, and to the point where it's not just affecting the traditional populations that it's affected in the past, like poor inner city black people or whatever.
It's old ladies now.
Yeah, old ladies.
And organic farmers.
Yeah, and working stiffs. And my all-time favorite case like that was a mayor of a city in Maryland who had a drug raid conducted on his house, and it wasn't even the right house. They had the wrong house, and they ended up shooting the dog at the house or something like that.
Leave it up to government to screw it up.
Right. Sure. Exactly. And so that now, as flagrant as some of this stuff has become, I think the system has started to lose its legitimacy. But I also think, though, that we're at the point where most people still don't feel that put upon by the system. I think that, in many ways, it's interesting, because the system is losing its legitimacy, and more people know what's up. you know, but their, you know, their lives still aren't that bad on a personal level. You know, they're not going to go out and man the barricades to do anything about this stuff. You know, they're still going to go to work every day and pay their taxes and, you know, and go about their business. You know, I don't know that it would necessarily be good to have a society that's completely falling apart, where people are so desperate they're going to go out and get into, you know, violent street protests and the stuff that we saw in the Middle East and a couple of years ago, and some places we've seen, you know, like we've seen in other countries. I don't know that we really want society to be in that kind of condition. But it is interesting, though, to see how more and more people are turning away from the system. And I think that will open up a lot of opportunities for libertarians, anarchists, and other people with a similar message to gain a wider following and a larger audience in the future.
Well, what happens if we just decide to go begin building our own alternative institutions? Well, is the government going to show up with tanks and machine guns? Are they going to shut us down for not having permits, you know?
Well, that's certainly a possibility. There's the example of in 1993, the Waco compound in Texas. And this was a fairly eccentric religious community that had more or less gone off and created this kind of separatist encampment for themselves. And they were alleged to have illegal weapons. And that's what they did. They sent in the federal government, sent in the tanks and ran them over and burned the compound down, killed over 100 people. And there was an incident like that in 1985 in Philadelphia. There was a black separatist group that I think were kind of back to the land types, and they were actually living in a suburban neighborhood, but they created all these gardens that were kind of growing wild, and, you know, that had created some conflict with their neighbors. So the LAPD just came in and dropped a bomb on them, basically. I think they dropped a bomb out of a helicopter, if I remember correctly. So that's certainly a possibility, and I do think that if movements like that were to grow, the system, the powers that be would certainly notice that and not want that to spread. And that gets back to what I was talking about earlier, about how we do need organizations that can defend our rights when they come under attack by the state. And it's also very important to that people who come under attack by the state defend each other's rights, even when they don't like each other. You know, for example, I remember hearing a talk once by a fellow named Larry Pratt. He heads up this group called Gun Owners of America, a pro-Second Amendment group. And he's very conservative, staunch social conservative, very religious. But he was talking about how he's worked with people that are pro-abortion, you know, people on the left, people from the American Civil Liberties Union around issues of common interest, like preserving basic civil rights and civil liberties. You know, in the 1960s, I talk about this a lot, because in the late 1960s, early 70s, that was really the last time in the United States that there was really large-scale social and political upheaval to the point that the government really started to feel threatened. In fact, there was one of my favorite anecdotes from that time period was when Lyndon Johnson, no, it was William Westmoreland. He was the a general in the Army. He was a commander of the American forces in Vietnam. He said that to prosecute the kind of land war he wanted to prosecute in Southeast Asia, he would need to send 1 million more American troops into Southeast Asia, in addition to the half million or so they already had there. And he told President Lyndon Johnson that. And then J. Edgar Hoover told head of the FBI at the time, told President Johnson, if you do that, I cannot guarantee the security of this country. And what he really meant was he couldn't guarantee the security of the state against the public. He was saying, well, you're going to have riots. You're going to have all kinds of resistance to something like that. So if you think twice before going down that road. But back then, that was you did have a lot of, you know, resistance to the establishment, and often militant resistance. You had groups like the Black Panthers and all kinds of stuff. And what they used to do was they had the program, the COINTELPRO program, where they would, infiltrate organizations. Sure. Yeah. And try to disrupt them from the inside. Another thing they do was they would bring conspiracy charges against people from radical groups to try to disrupt the organizations, to distract them with all sorts of legal proceedings, all sorts of frame-up efforts. You had all sorts of conspiracy trials there were something like 65 conspiracy trials during that time period of leaders of different kinds of, you know, anti-establishment movements of all kinds. Most of those cases, the political dissidents actually won. Like, I remember seeing an interview with one of the founders of the Black Panthers once, where he was saying that he said they won something like 98% or 95% of all their cases in court. You know, but what the effect that it had is, even though they ended up winning, it disrupted all of their activities and made them that much less effective as a political organization. So and that kind of thing still goes on today. I know in the militia movement in the 90s, when that started to develop, I used to see that. I used to see federal agents go out and entrap, you know, a bunch of backwoods yokels who call themselves a militia into doing something stupid, you know, sawing off shotguns or, you know, converting a semi-automatic weapon to an automatic weapon, and then they try to bust them for, you know, some kind of trumped-up racketeering charge for distributing illegal weapons. Or I've seen that in the anarchists, the left anarchist scene. You know, they do the same thing. They go find these kids, these anarchist kids, and you know, talk them into developing weird plans for, you know, blowing up a bridge or something, which is something they never even planned to do, or something that's never going to even happen. And then they try to railroad them on some sort of conspiracy charges or terrorism charges. And I've seen that, you know, there are cases where they've done that to Muslims as well. You know, a group of Muslims that, talk a lot about, you know, talk a big game, but never actually do anything. They try to railroad those on all sorts of, you know, trumped up conspiracy charges, yeah, of, you know, making threats and stuff like that. And so we could expect that kind of stuff to happen more and more as different kinds of movements of this, you know, grow and expand that are against the system. You know, and like I said, the way to resist that is to know that it can happen. And to support other people who come under attack by the system. Like I talked about the homeschool movement earlier. You know, like I said, that the reason we can do homeschooling in the United States is because, you know, people from all different kinds of backgrounds that wanted to do homeschooling, whether it's Christian fundamentalists, whether it's countercultural types, came along and said, "Hey, we're going to do this," and they supported each other. They built their movement. They lobbied the government. They had the lawyers there. You know, they had all the stuff that they needed to be able to defend their rights. And that's what it takes.
So, could this work for an anarchist society? I mean, are we just years off? Because what if a bunch of us got together and said, "Okay, we're going to create our own society. We don't want to go lobby the government because we don't want to use their system. We want to be out of their system." But
well, sure,
they don't want to let you out. See?
Well, yeah, that's the catch-22, and that gets back to the argument that radical political movements have always had among themselves, and that is the question of reform versus revolution. And you see this among anarchists and libertarians, just like you see it among socialists and other people, you know, that have some kind of, you know, political point of view that's way outside the mainstream. And that is, you know, do we go out and work for really radical changes in society, or and just ignore mainstream institutions and mainstream politics, or do we work within the system? And my take on that is, I don't consider my point of view on it obviously to be the final word or anything like that. But my take on that is that it really has to be some of both, because I think that if you just go off and do you know, create alternative infrastructure and alternative institutions, you know, like bitcoins or whatever, what you do is when you get to a certain point that you're perceived as a threat, the system will come down on you. Mm-hmm. For example, recently, I think somebody from Bitcoin was actually arrested. And, you know, and then look at what the system did to the Reddit guy, to Aaron Swartz. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's plenty of examples of that. So for the other side of it is, you've got to have the what I call, I've always called it, the inside outside strategy, and that is, on one hand, you kind of, you know, work within the ordinary mainstream society to defend your own rights and create space for yourself to resist, to build these more radical projects. You know, like in the 60s, they did that. You know, you had the Black Panthers that would get into armed confrontations with cops on the street over police brutality, but then they had their lawyers that were right behind them when they went to court, you know, the William Kunstlers and people like that. So I really think that it has to be a little bit of both.
So you can be an anarchist, but then also maybe help out some libertarians and some of their causes, right?
Yeah. Support sure. Them. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, you know, Murray Rothbard, he was one of the godfathers of modern libertarianism. Mm-hmm. And, And, you know, that's sort of the approach he took. I mean, his thinking is pretty radical. If you read his books, you know, he was a pretty dyed-in-the-wool anarchist.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when it came to strategic matters, he often had a lot of interesting ideas on strategy, and he'd go out and align himself with anybody he thought was doing anything to combat the state at the time. He'd work with the far right and the far left and the center left and the center right, depending on who they were. But he also advocated just very mainstream, middle-of-the-road activism. You know, on one hand, he was, you know, even in the late 60s and early 70s, you know, he would say, yeah, you know, support black power and support the anti-war movement and support the Chicago 7, you know, but vote for Nixon against McGovern because he's less for big government than McGovern. You know, mm-hmm. He had that kind of perspective. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know that there's really any one right answer to that kind of stuff. It's a complicated question. You know, there are problems with any direction you want to take it in.
Well, that's why you were talking about, that's the one issue that's been with the anarchist movement is strategy. And this really is a long-term chess game, really, right?
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I think that one weakness that a lot of anarchists have is that they tend to be idealists in this. I mean, it's not being an idealist is not a weakness by itself. You know, I mean, being somebody that's very committed to some ideal or some cause or some goal you want to achieve obviously is a very powerful motivating factor for many people. But one problem that can have is, you know, you can have an excess of idealism to the point where you never get anything done. You know, it's all about, well, we're going to go off and live in the monastery and meditate 10 hours a day. But what's going to happen to the rest of the world along the way? And I think that, you know, there are a lot of people that have this very idealistic view of these kinds of things. And like you said, it's a chess game, but they don't like to play the chess game. Mm-hmm. You know, to them, it's like, you know, that's dirty. You know, that's tainted. You know, it's a dirty game. And
it's
it
Masonic.
Is. Yeah, it is. It is. But I think that's a weakness in many ways as well. You know, I'd like to see more Machiavellian anarchists come along.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and in your book, actually, I think it was part 6, you gave some good strategic formulations. Yeah, you asked the question, what might be some thick values that might be helpful for combating existing states of the kind found in the contemporary first world? I mean, you've done an excellent job actually presenting some strategies and long-term goals.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have this concept that I call anarcho-populism. You know, I mentioned pan-secessionism earlier, and that's the idea of just developing local and regional independence movements that are able to just essentially secede from central government and then develop alternative institutions that secede from the state's infrastructure. And I'm also into this concept that I call anarcho-populism, a libertarian populism, and that's the idea of making the struggle against the system into a populist movement, a people's movement. You know, it's the people against the elite, the people against the ruling class, the people against the state. You know, not a class struggle type of thing in a Marxist sense, where it's just all about this very narrow, rigid class, you know, determinism and
like Occupy Wall Street.
Yeah, well, you know, Occupy Wall Street was a mixed bag. You a lot of the issues being raised there were legitimate issues, and a lot of, you know, there were a lot of different kinds of people from different backgrounds that participated in that. I know libertarians that participated in that, and an honest anarchist, and some Ron Paul people, you know, along with you know, Maoists and you know, all kinds of kooks as well. That's what you're going to find, though, in any kind of people's movement, you know, whether it's the left or the right or some combination thereof. You're going to find people with all sorts of crazy opinions. You know, that's one thing I'm always asked about. You know, I've had people tell me, because I'm sure if you've looked over my website or if you looked them over my Facebook page, you know I associate with all sorts of political movements, yeah. Some of which are very fringe, some of which have a lot of ideas that are very heretical about a lot of things. Some of them have opinions that are considered, you know, a bit shaky in terms of their credibility, you know, as well as a lot of individuals that have a less than stellar reputation, or, you know, who are considered crazy or whatever. And I've had some people say, well, Keith, you know, you'd get further if you didn't associate with all these crazy people. But, you know, the thing is, though, any kind of people's movement is going to have all kinds of people in it.
That's
including
true.
including crazy people and including, you know, a bit shady people at times, you know, and that's true on the left, the right. That's just human nature. You know, you're not going to, it's not thing that's unique to any one political philosophy. So, you know, like I said, I'm a big tent libertarian or a Big Ten anarchist or whatever I am. Yeah, there are a lot of different kinds of political factions and anarchist factions that I recognize as legitimate branches of the movement or the collection of movements or whatever that I don't personally agree with. I mentioned primitivism earlier in the conversation. I think honestly, my honest opinion about primitivism is that if it was put into practice on any massive scale, most people would die of disease and starvation. But if other people feel differently, that's fine. I don't really see primitivism as anything that's ever going to take over the whole society. Another thing that I'm vociferously criticized by some anarchists and libertarians from the left is being associated with white nationalists and some of these movements that come under the label of neo-reactionary or dark enlightenment or alternative right or, ethno-states, the people that want to have an all-white ethno-state and Montana or something like that. And
well, they should be able to have that if that's what those people want.
In many ways, I actually, there's very little that I do or talk about that there's not some precedent for in anarchist history or in libertarian history. In the classical anarchist movement of Spain in the 1920s and 30s, they were actually closely associated with the independence movements in places like Catalonia and among the Basque people, which were precisely that. Those were ethno-statist movements of people who felt they were in some way being oppressed or denied self-determination by the wider society, by the Spanish government at the time. And that's more or less what some of these white nationalist folks are today, as well as Native American tribes like the Lakota Republic or like some of the Afrocentric or black nationalist groups, the Nation of Islam and other tendencies like that as well. In all of those kinds of groups, the effect that they have is to break down the legitimacy of the overarching state system. Whether you like their individual beliefs or not, Nation of Islam, whether you believe in their particular interpretation of the Islamic faith or not, that still has that effect of breaking down the legitimacy of that system. There's the group in Vermont, the Second Vermont Republic, which is a very leftward leaning group. I know a fellow who wants to build a Marxist secessionist movement in Ohio, I think it's in Illinois. He wants to have his own little communist city state in Illinois or something. And to that, I'd say good luck to you, friend. Yeah.
All
of these kinds of ideas collectively as they grow and spread is what will have the effect of bringing down the overarching state system. Freedom means people going off and doing other things and that they want to do. And the way some people practice their freedom might not be the way you'd want to practice it, but that's what it's all about. For example, freedom of religion. One of the great achievements of the Enlightenment, one of the great achievements of classical American society and the Constitution and all that, was separating church and state to where, in the United States, even today, you can more or less belong to any church you want to or no church at all. You can advocate for any religious point of view that you want, or you can be an atheist or whatever. And different people use that in different ways. You have, probably as much religious diversity as you do in any other country, except maybe India. And you have religious movements, religious denominations that are very conservative, very fundamentalist in many ways, very traditional. You have others that are, very ecumenical, even very left wing. Some Episcopalian churches or some Methodist churches sound more like Marxists than Christians much of the time. That's their particular interpretation of their particular religious tradition. You've got the Mormon people, you got the Jehovah's Witnesses coming around knocking on your door on Sunday morning. And that's what freedom is. Then you've got the American atheists and you've got these new atheist people and you've got the Freedom From Religion Foundation. And that's what freedom is. It's about people using their freedom in all different kinds of ways, even polar opposite ways.
Yeah. Well, my problem right now is it seems like all these people think that America is a free market system right now, which is total bullshit. And no one's talking about the role of the state in facilitating what we're looking at today as modern capitalism, And people are then demanding socialism. Okay, we need that now in America. And people are so hot for that right now.
Well, on the economic questions, that's something that most people, I think, from all over the spectrum get rather confused about in a lot of ways. And on one hand, there are some people from the left liberals and others further to the left who insist, as you were saying, that the United States is a free market society. And they'll tell you what we've got is just too much free enterprise.
Yeah, exactly.
Too much libertarianism. You know, if you go to some of the really reactionary liberal web zines like Slate.com or Salon.com, you'll see them saying that, well, you know, what we've got in America today, what's really wrong with the system? If we've got too much libertarianism, and you know, isn't it terrible that libertarianism dominates our society today? And which to those of us who are actually involved in libertarian movements, that's a joke. But you know, that's how they see it. You know, and of course they think, you know, in their mind, any kind of market relations and market economy is libertarianism. You see parallels to that on the left. I mean, on the right as well. They like, for example, there are a lot of conservatives who say, well, Obama is a communist Muslim and things like that. I don't really see him in that light at all. I see him as basically being a careerist politician, and to the degree that he believes in anything at all, he just has the standard kind of left progressive, left liberal perspective that, you know, the academic left, you know, that someone that went to Columbia and institutions like that would normally have. And he's largely a tool of the big banking institutions, the international banking institutions that have their hands in all the political parties, Goldman Sachs and all that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as far as state intervention in the economy, we don't really have, certainly don't have libertarianism or free enterprise, but we don't really have full-on socialism either. It's not really a planned economy, you know, where all state, industry is nationalized under the ownership of the state. It's more of a Keynesian or maybe social democratic model. It's a sort of a hybrid capitalism and socialism. It's really a hybrid of plutocracy. You know, that is, you have a wealthy elite class that's aligned with the state, which is somewhat different than, or, you know, state capitalism, I suppose, which is somewhat different than free enterprise per se. And then that's probably the right half of the system. And then the left half is the welfare state and social democracy and Keynesianism and all of the, you know, then the big public sector bureaucracy that's. And that's the system that most modern countries have. It's in Europe they probably go a little bit more to the leftward end, more towards the Keynesian and social democratic end, and in Asian countries they probably go to more to the rightward end. They practice a more national capitalism there, or economic nationalism, I guess, is probably a more appropriate term, maybe mercantilism. But all of the modern countries have more or less the same variation of that system.
And what about Fabian socialism? Haven't they infiltrated America quite deeply?
Yeah, well, the Fabians, that's social democracy. That's just the British word for social democracy. We've seen the welfare state grow exponentially in the United States. It starts with the progressive era, and you see the inklings of that, and then it's grows fairly large to a much greater degree during the New Deal. And then there was the Great Society, and then it's continued to expand since then. I mean, it may have been chipped away at in certain corners here and there. You know, there was the Welfare Reform Act of the 90s and so forth. But we do see this. What we've seen actually in the United States isn't so much Fabianism per se, because to date we don't really have anything like the National Health Service or anything like that. We now have Obamacare, what we've seen is the growth of this managerial class in the United States, which is just there was a really interesting book that was published back in the 1930s called The Managerial Revolution by James Burnham. He was actually a former Trotskyite, a former communist, who moved somewhat rightward, but a lot of his views today would be considered something like neoconservatism. He actually wrote a book called The Managerial Revolution in the 1930s, and he's talking about the growth of massive bureaucratic institutions during that time period, during the middle part of the 20th century, and how this was something that was actually happening in a lot of different countries at once, and that it seemed to cut across different ideologies and economic systems. For example, in England and America, you had the growth of the welfare state, you know, Fabian socialism in England and the New Deal and things like that. In America, in Central Europe and Italy and Germany, you had fascism and national socialism. And, of course, in Russia, you had Bolshevism, communism. What he was saying, that the one common thread in all these systems, though, was the growth of this massive bureaucratic class and this massive managerial class within all institutions in a way that hadn't previously existed. And you had this massive growth of the public sector. You have an agency for everything. You have a bureaucracy for everything. In a way that you didn't previously. And in fact, I think a lot of that really helps to define a lot of post-war politics. When we think of the traditional middle class in the United States, we think of middle America. That's the middle class. And we think of small businessmen and Main Street, Chamber of Commerce and that kind of stuff. Independent farmers and all that. But we have this new kind of middle class that has grown up, I think, in the last half century that is the public sector. It's the professional class that staffs the public sector, all the lawyers and bureaucrats and specialists and, academics and all of these kinds of people. I don't know. I don't even know what you'd call that. Would you call it socialism? Would you call it bureaucratism? Would you call it collectivism?
Of all those things.
Some kind of state capitalism. Also even the distinction between business and government is becoming increasingly blurred. When you look at how many corporations there are that are directly aligned with the government, even dependent on the government for most of their business. Is that really capitalism? Even though they're technically private companies and privately owned, if they're making all their money off of, say, subsidies or contracts with the state, is that really a free market institution?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I don't even know what we call this system. It's a little bit of everything, like you said.
A couple last questions for you. What do you think an economy would look like devoid of the state in an anarchist society?
Well, I think it's something that you can't really plan for. Any kind of economic system that somebody tries to plan for ends up not happening, or at least going terribly awry. One of the two. But I think that it would be very diverse. You would probably have some economic institutions that were essentially what free market libertarians idealize, private entrepreneurs and individual enterprises and mom and pop shops and small farmers and that kind of thing. And you'd probably have some institutions that the left-wing anarchist and libertarian socialists tend to favor, things like labor federations and worker cooperatives and communes and stuff like the Israel's kibbutz system, and there are prototypes for things like that around the world today. Yeah. And there's a lot of things that are on that similar models, but don't really fall under any label. One illustration I've talked about on the podcast that I do before was there's a community in South Africa called Arania. It's it's basically a conservative Afrikaner, Calvinist, white nationalist community, but they're basically a commune. But at the same time, there are a lot of people that are into anarcho-capitalism who consider them a model for a kind of almost an anarcho-capitalist private community, like someone like Hans Hermann Hoppe, somebody like that or Murray Rothbard would advocate. So it's hard to say. What are they? Are they left or right? Are they capitalist? Are they socialist? Are they communist? Who knows? But I think you'd see an economic system where economic power is not nearly as concentrated into large banks and large corporations and institutions of that type that really cannot exist without the state. If you look at the biggest supposed private sector institutions or biggest business corporations or biggest banking institutions, what you find is that most all of them are very heavily intertwined with the state get a lot of assistance from the state, get a lot of legislative and legal privilege from the state, get a lot of subsidies from the state, do a lot of business with the state. And without the state, it's doubtful that they would be nearly as large. Now, that doesn't mean you'd have perfect equality either. It doesn't mean nobody would ever be richer than anybody else or anything like that. That's not what I'm saying. But I don't think you'd see the kinds of concentrations of economic power that we see in existing societies, you know, whether you want to call them capitalists or socialists or whatever, I do think you would see a lot more effort for people to achieve economic independence in a lot of ways. I don't necessarily think even in private institutions you'd see quite the level of the top down corporate structure, the kind of pyramid structure that we have nowadays. I think you'd see a lot more in the way of partnerships and, you know, de facto cooperatives and a lot more entrepreneurship and individual enterprises and some, you know, collective, you know, voluntarily collectivist or quasi-socialistic communities as well. You've got the in Spain now, they've got the it's been there for a while, the Mondragon Worker Cooperative Federation, which is a very successful enterprise that's organized on what to order basically socialist principles. There's a commune, a sort of a countercultural commune that lives that exists not far from where I live. It's been there for 40 years. It's very new agey, kind of hippie-ish. It's very successful, economically self-sufficient, and it's almost like a prototypical anarcho-communist community. So I think you'd see the whole spectrum of economic arrangements. But I think the one thing you wouldn't see is the kind of concentrated economic power that we have now. And in societies, in lesser developed societies, I think these principles are particularly important to some of those societies, even more so than they are to the more affluent societies. Because I certainly don't think that in places like Africa, Latin America, and Asia, you'd see the kind of concentration of economic power that you find there. Where you have some people that live in absolute poverty, you know, life-threatening poverty, and then other people that are live in opulence, you know, often usually through political means, you know, usually through land grabs and looting the treasury and things like that as well. So I think these kinds of ideas are particularly relevant to those societies.
Yeah, I just think of even on a spiritual, emotional level. I mean, imagine how high we could soar humanity with ultimate freedom like this. And it would be fun to see how the different communities would flourish and what new things would come about and new inventions, and people could actually follow their bliss, you know, do what they love, be where they want to be.
Sure, and some communities would fail. I mean, and wouldn't turn out so well too. You know, that's just how freedom works.
But then that's how they learn.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, there would be, you know, some people I know, like particularly from the statist left or whatever, the PC left, will tell me, you know, Keith, with your system, you know, do you know that some people are going to do awful things? They're going to set up snake handler communities and, you know, in weird religious cults and practice backward superstitions and, you know, and have, you know, communities with polygamous communities with their 700 wives or whatever. You know, I'm like, and I always say, let them, you know, and if it doesn't turn out well for them, well, that's too bad for them. I mean, you know, that'll be the Edsel of communities. You know, there have been products that have been developed and sold on the market that didn't turn out so well.
Yeah. That's
what life is. You know, there's a trial and error and experimentation and failure.
Right.
That's how you
part of evolution.
Right.
Well, and the thing is, to answer that question, is like, we already have all those things. There's polygamists, there's snake handlers, there's everything already.
It's interesting how both sides of the spectrum, the left and right, they raise all of these sky is falling scenarios. If you talk to the left about any of these ideas, you know, you think, well, they say, well, a libertarian society is going to be one where, you know, everybody's carrying a machine gun on the street,
God.
and racist organizations beating up black people. And
they're not
friends
with any libertarians at all, because
that's
not how it is.
And then the right is the same way. Well, in a libertarian society, everybody's going to be having sex in the street, and everybody's going to be high on drugs all the time, and nobody's going to ever get any work done.
I've heard someone say, "Oh, libertarians are just Republicans on drugs, aren't they?"
And then a lot of conservatives will basically say they're, you know, right wing hippies or something like that. You know, it's free market leftists.
It's people who mind their own business. That's what that is.
Sure,
you know?
Sure, exactly. Absolutely.
And then I look at thinking of what a little communist commune would be, and I just think, oh my God, what hell? Think of all the drama that's going to be in there, and the infighting and the picking, and that's not equal, and where's your share? You got more, you know? It's just like...
Well, there are a lot of families that are set up like that now, so it's, I don't know that we that much different either.
Yeah. Ugh. Well, thank you, Keith. I've learned a lot today, and I really enjoyed speaking with you.
Okay, well, it's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me on, Lana.
AttackTheSystem.com is your website since 2001, actually. Anything else you'd like to mention?
Well, I do podcasts of my own, so stay tuned to AttackTheSystem.com, and you'll see that I'm regularly posting new podcasts. I do have the book out, Attack the System is the name of the book. It's subtitled A New Anarchist Perspective for the 21st Century. It's available through Amazon.com. It's also available on the website. If you just go click on the photo of the book on the website, it'll take you to a site where you can order it. I have another book out as well. It's called El Salvador, War by Proxy. That is a book that I wrote that talks about American foreign policy in El Salvador during the 1980s, and it gives you a good glimpse into what U.S. foreign policy is really about, particularly in the lesser developed parts of the world. There's another book that's a reprint of one of Emma Goldman's classic works, Anarchism and Other Essays. It was originally published in 1910. It's been reissued by a British publishing company, Black House, and they asked me to write a new introduction to that, and I wrote a fairly extensive introduction to that, and that's also available through Amazon as well. So check some of those out.
So you think you're on any government terrorist watch lists?
Probably. I've never actually tried to get any of my information through the Freedom of Information Act or any of that stuff. But yeah, I'm sure my name's on plenty of lists by now, as long as I've been doing this.
All right, Keith. Thanks again. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
There will never, ever exist one universal system of governance that will work for everyone. That's impossible. But imagine if each political interest group did get their own territory to create whatever kind of society they wished. The local residents would be willing participants living how they chose to and living with who they wanted to. They would be free to choose their government, society, and economic structure. In my case, I wouldn't want any governance, and I sure would love to experience a true free enterprise system. I think it would be very telling to watch each territory either succeed or completely fail. I'm betting this is exactly what the powers that be who are in control do not want, because the inorganic systems they create would be sized up for what they really are. We cannot prevent people from doing what is in their nature, so be it communism or be it individualism. Why can't we have a world that encompasses all desires? At the end of the day, humans are tribal and will always segregate with people who are like-minded, and I don't see anything wrong with that. Take care.
For centuries, the state has robbed people at that point and called it taxation. For centuries, the state has enslaved people into its armed battalions and called it conscription. This is taxation. the skint. For centuries, the state has robbed people at bayonet point and called it taxation. For centuries, the state has enslaved people into its army battalions and called it conscription. We'll be right back.